morning, it's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why our guest says emergency service providers are crucial to healthcare in rural Wisconsin.
First, the Marquette Law School released a new poll today that surveyed Wisconsinites on a variety of topics, from the race for president to the rematch of Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson to represent Wisconsin in the U.S. Senate.
The poll also looked at Governor Scott Walker's approval rating in the state. This is the second poll since Walker dropped out of the Republican race for president.
The poll sampled 803 registered voters from around the state, with 326 identifying as Republican and 374 as Democrats. The margin of error for the entire poll was plus or minus 4.2%.
Joining us now is Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette Law School poll and professor of law and public policy at Marquette University. Charles, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
So let's start with the remaining candidates for president on the Republican side. Who is leading in Wisconsin right now?
Ben Carson is taking the lead in this month's poll with 22%, but he's very closely followed by Trump at 19 and Rubio at 19. And the gap between those is within the margin of error. In September, it was Trump on top with 20%. Carson at 16 and Rubio at 14. So Rubio's up 5, Carson's up 6, and Trump is down 1 from the September polls. Nobody else made it into double digits, though Ted Cruz was 4th at 9% and Jeb Bush further back at just 6%.
So Marco Rubio has made the most progress percentage-wise since the last poll. What would you attribute that movement to?
Well, the obvious is debate performance, which was generally well received. Our poll was in the field the Thursday through Sunday after the debate held in Milwaukee, and also overlapped the Democratic debate from Iowa on Saturday night, though most of our interviews were completed before the Democratic debate was held. We've seen Rubio rise in national polls as well, and I think what we're seeing in Wisconsin broadly reflects those national shifts.
And do you think that there is much of a difference if a debate that is right before a poll is actually held in that state? Does that make any kind of difference?
No, I don't think we see evidence of that from past polling. There certainly can be shifts if there's something truly dramatic that happens in a debate, but those are actually more the exception than the rule. Excuse me. And I think what we saw here was a good debate that exhibited differences in policies among the candidates, but not one that fundamentally changed the standing of the candidates.
So
the trends that we've seen have been continuing since the debate.
Well, let's move over to the Democratic side of the ballot now. What did you see as far as who Wisconsinites are liking as a Democratic candidate for president?
Here, Hillary Clinton has a lead at 50% to Sanders at 41%. And Martin O'Malley is way back at 2%. In September, we were still including Joe Biden in the question. And at that point, Clinton was at 42, Sanders at 30. So the margin between the two has narrowed from 12 to 9 points, as Biden's 17% of supporters have redistributed themselves among those other candidates.
And are you able to see where those Biden supporters have gone?
No, we did not ask people to remember whether they would have liked Biden to be in the race. I think you just see the net changes, relatively modest, from a 12-point to a 9-point Clinton advantage suggests that while there may have been some shifting of due to Biden supporters, that's a relatively modest change over a six-week period.
Now, you looked also at who would be the strongest candidate from one party against potential candidates on the other side. Who looks the strongest on each side when they're matched up against the opponent?
Here it's quite interesting. Sanders does better against the three Republicans tested, Carson, Rubio, and Trump. Sanders does better against all three of those than Clinton does. And in fact, Clinton trails by 1 percentage point Carson and Rubio. In both cases, Clinton's at 44, but both Carson and Rubio are at 45. We had not asked about Carson before, but back in September, Clinton had an 8-point lead on Rubio, 48 to 40. So that's a net 9-point shift to put Rubio just a single percentage point ahead. Clinton beats Trump 48-38, but Sanders beats Trump 52-35. So what we're seeing is, while Clinton is leading in the Democratic primary, Sanders does a little better against all three of these Republicans than Clinton does, and Clinton actually is in essentially a tie, but just 1 point behind in the case of Carson and Rubio. By the way, that's very similar to national polls, which has shown a similar trend in the Clinton versus Carson and Rubio matchups. So as with the primary, we're seeing Wisconsin track national trends in that way.
We're talking with Charles Franklin. He's director of the Marquette Law School poll, which released its most recent findings just today. Now let's look at the U.S. Senate race. We have a matchup of incumbent Ron Johnson, a Republican, being challenged by Democrat Russ Feingold, who held the seat before Johnson. What are you seeing in that race?
In this race, Feingold has an advantage 49% to Johnson's 38%. That's a little changed. In September, it was 50% for Feingold, 36% for Johnson. So hardly any movement, a couple of points either way. Feingold has led in the four polls we've now asked this question in this year, and has averaged around 49, plus or minus a couple, while Johnson has averaged around 39, plus or minus a couple. So this month's poll is in that same ballpark. And most importantly, we're not seeing a sharp trend for or against either of these candidates yet, but we're just barely less than a year out from the election, so a long ways to go on that one.
And that brings up a question, because as of yet, neither Johnson nor Feingold have a primary opponent, so they're a year out. Going back just briefly to the presidential, we're 3 months out from the primary. Mm-hmm. Do you expect a lot of movement there?
Certainly I do, in two ways. One is, we almost always see a good deal of shuffling in the month that leads up to the start of voting in the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary. So I would expect us to see a lot of turmoil in the polling in January as we get into that last month before the election. The other is, we still have a lot of candidates on the Republican side who are polling at 1 point, 1 percentage point, or even 0 percentage points. It's very hard to see how they stay in the race after the voting begins, unless they surprise us by suddenly doing a lot better. That means there's necessarily going to be a good deal of shuffling of the candidates as we get into the voting in February and March before we get to vote in April. And there the real question is, will there still be a contest in April when we vote, or will it have been settled in the months before, in the 2 months before?
So you also asked voters about Governor Walker's approval rating in the state. In September, it was 37% approving, 59% disapproving. What did you come up with this time?
This time it's 38 approve, 58 disapprove. That's hardly changed and is part of a pattern in 2014 where his approval rating has been in this same ballpark. We've seen approvals this year of 41, 39, 37, and now 38. So it's a tick 1 point up this month compared to September, but the last three polls have all been in the same range. We've not seen a big change one way or another since he left the presidential race.
Those are all overall numbers, but do you see any difference in how Republicans or Democrats are rating him?
Well, it's hardly a surprise that Democrats are pretty negative about the governor and have been for a long time. I think the most important thing is that while Republicans are positive towards the governor, independents are negative, more disapproval than approval. And that's a change for him, and certainly an area where if he's going to recover his standing, he needs to bring some of those back. Right now, among independents, 58% disapprove, only 29% approve.
And Charles, you tweeted earlier this afternoon that Wisconsin voters are, quote, quite pessimistic, end quote, about state jobs and the picture there right now. What in this poll led you to think that that's a good summary of the feeling out there?
Yeah, we're seeing quite a shift in perspective on jobs in the state lately and the economy more generally. We've been asking for quite a while if people think Wisconsin is adding jobs faster, the same, or lagging behind other states. And this month, 57% say lagging behind, 31% the same, just 6% say faster. In three times we've asked that question in 2015, lagging behind has been running right at 50%, up about 10 percentage points from where it was during 2014 and 2013. So that's a sign of a real change in the public's perception of the jobs picture here. Part of that is probably mass layoffs, which have been widely reported and have gone up this year compared to last year. We asked if people had heard of the closing of plants in Waukesha and Madison, the GE and Oscar Mayer plants. 70% statewide had heard of those closings. Only 30% had not. And when we asked about new hiring and additional jobs at Amazon and Quad Graphics, it was an even split. 50% had heard, 49% not heard. And those that had heard were heavily concentrated in the Milwaukee media market, the southeastern part of the state where those jobs are located. So you see some asymmetry here between bad news and good news. And balancing that is a continued decline in the state unemployment rate, which suggests maybe the jobs picture is not so bad. So the public is really taking a fairly pessimistic view of the situation right now.
Charles, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Charles Franklin, a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. You can find a link to the latest Marquette Law School poll, which was released today, on the Central Time Facebook page. We're taking a look at the difficulties that rural emergency medical services face and how one organization is trying to help.
Rural EMS providers are a major part of the healthcare system in underserved areas, but they often face difficulties finding volunteers, equipment, and funding for the services they provide.
Enter the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, which works with more than 60 rural hospitals, clinics, and other healthcare providers across the state to fund projects and address a range of issues.
For more on these efforts, we're joined now by John Eich, the director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit more about what the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health does.
Okay, so there is an Office of Rural Health in every state. We are the Wisconsin version, and our mission is to help improve the access to care in rural areas, health care, and improve the quality of that care. So we work with rural hospitals, clinics, and EMS, as you said. We tend to provide support and resources for them to keep their doors open, serve rural residents, and to keep their quality climbing. We do really well in quality in Wisconsin, but we're always ready to do better.
And why are some of these rural providers struggling right now?
Well, specifically to EMS, I think the Affordable Care Act has changed the way we do healthcare, and for good or bad, it's changed things. And so a lot of providers across the board are trying to cope with that. But in EMS in particular, some of the issues we see is that I believe in the last poll, it was 66% of services in Wisconsin are volunteer. Many of those are in rural areas. And so we see a lot of volunteers, and volunteerism is going down. People are the boomers are aging out of jobs, and as they do, they are less likely to want to stand by the side of a cold highway and haul people in and out. And so we're struggling to fill those very important roles.
And do you have a younger generation coming up? What are you doing to try to nurture that younger generation?
Well, I think that in general, people are getting a little desperate. And so they're starting to, in other words, to get to recruit, and they're starting to reach out in new and innovative ways. So the downside is it's more of a stress, but the upside is we're really trying some new things. One of those projects we funded this last summer up in Ashland, and it was called the Rescue Divas. Now, generally, when you when they recruit, they at the state fair or a county fair or local festival, they'll pull out a table and say, "Hey, come and join EMS, be a volunteer. It's great work." Those efforts tend to attract more men than women. And so they thought, well, let's try targeting girls for this. Let's try and grow our own. And so they actually addressed middle school girls because they thought that high school girls would be too busy. So they did a summer camp at Northland College in Ashland, and they did a residential program for 5 days, and they did a bunch of great modules. They did med flight, they did search and rescue, they did water rescue with Coast Guard, and they walked them through all of these, and it was so successful and popular that the boys got jealous. Now they want to do it. And the high school girls as well said that they want to do it as well. So it was great to see them getting innovative. It's great to see them trying to reach out and have a more diverse and balanced set of crews. The instructors were almost all women as well in EMS crews. So that's one of the ways that they're being innovative about recruiting more in rural. And I'd like to say, you know, one of the things that the Office of Rural Health is why we're interested in EMS is EMS is a critical part of healthcare delivery in urban and rural. But in rural areas, we've got a distance issue. And so you think of that golden hour. If you can address trauma in the first 60 minutes, you have much better outcomes. And so if you are 15 minutes away from where they have to drive to get you, and then you're 15 minutes back to a hospital, it's very important what the person that shows up can do for you.
Does that mean that they take on some extra significance, EMS providers in these rural areas they might not have in, say, an urban area?
They are much more important, and yet it feels like they get fewer resources. They're much more likely to be volunteer. They're much more likely to be understaffed just because they're doing everything they can. They're dancing and juggling at the same time, trying to get it to work. These are issues that affect urban as well, but it just feels more critical in rural areas.
We're talking to John Eich right now, director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, and we're talking about his organization's effort to recruit and retain EMTs in rural Wisconsin. And another thing that you're working on, John, is called community paramedics. This is something growing around the state. Tell us about what that effort involves.
Sure. So this is an effort to take EMS tends to be reactive. In other words, we call them in an emergency. This is an attempt to take them to be proactive, to be the outreach arm, sort of like the visiting doctor or visiting nurse. But in many areas, especially rural areas, we don't tend to have enough doctors or enough nurses. And so we use what providers we have. And so we use paramedics to do home visits. After you're discharged from a hospital, a lot of times you'll have a confusing set of instructions. Hospitals do their best. They print out instructions and all of that. But still, you've just gotten out of perhaps a traumatic surgery. You're perhaps not at your best mentally. And so to have somebody visit your home and help walk you through what's needed can be very helpful. So they're starting to do this in Wisconsin. Crews around the state, both urban and rural, are starting community paramedics. It's not paid for right away by CMS, Medicaid and Medicare, but that's, we hope, on the way. And so hospitals are bootstrapping it a lot of times.
Do you see people in these communities being receptive to that, getting a little additional TLC, as it were, from EMTs instead of maybe their own doctor, their own healthcare provider?
Yeah, people are very pleased with these programs. The issue has always been, how do we pay for this? Health providers live and breathe on the reimbursement that they get. It's how they keep their doors open. And so if they can bill for it, we're all good. If they can't, which they can't currently, they try and get grants for it. They try and get hospitals to fund it. I mean, a hospital can look at readmissions. Unnecessary readmissions are a thing they can get dinged for financially from CMS. And so if they say, well, if we prevent readmissions, then we will be making money. So they can invest money to save money down the road. But that's a harder sell than it is, we can just bill for this service.
So you said this is a time where the volunteerism for EMS is slipping. How do you keep it on people's radars and remember that it is a resource that needs to be renewed?
It's so they're trying everything they can. They're still having the booth at the fair. They're still reaching out through community communications. They're reaching out through churches and other faith-based avenues. They're reaching out at the, you know, putting a sign up at the gas station. And they're trying new things like this Rescue Divas. I like to think that we're going to see some really innovative and creative ways, and we'll hopefully be stronger down the road. But it will be a push to do this. The other thing is, I think a lot of times the public sees an ambulance and they see a bus driver and they don't think of the medic inside that ambulance. They also assume that it's paid for, like, oh, I'm sure that's just like the fire department. It's paid for by my taxes or cell phone service. But it's not paid for by either of those things a lot of times. This is why they're volunteer. They do not get funded in the same way that a lot of our public emergency services are. And so we need to start thinking of them as things to be funded, both locally and at the state level.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for listening.
That was John Ike telling us about his organization's efforts to recruit and retain EMTs in rural Wisconsin. He's the director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health.
Milwaukee has been called the most segregated city in America, and its public school system is in crisis.
Milwaukee is also home to a strong school choice movement with advocates for parents to be able to apply public money towards sending their children to private schools.
Throughout its history, Milwaukee's schools and educational system have been impacted by racial and economic disparities. Joining us now is James Nelson. He's the author of Educating Milwaukee, How One City's History of Segregation and Struggle Shaped Its Schools. Jim teaches high school social studies at the Golda Meier School in Milwaukee, which is a public magnet school for college-bound students in grades 3 through 12. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, I'm happy to be here.
Well, the word choice is used a lot when talking about educational policies and systems. It's often shorthand for voucher school programs where public education dollars can be taken with a student to a private school. But you use choice much more broadly in your book. Why don't you tell us what it means to you?
Sure. I use choice in the literal sense of the word, the act of making decisions, the act of making actions. So in my book, I break up the history of school choice into three phases. The first phase, which ended in the 1970s, was the era of no choice. That's the segregation era. Then from the mid-70s up until about the early to mid-90s, you have the era of forced choice, when desegregation was encouraged, and in some cases not just encouraged, but was actually mandated. And then finally, we get up to the era of school choice since the early 90s, which for me includes vouchers, charter schools, open enrollment in the suburbs, various configurations of schools such as a 6-12 format, magnet schools, Montessori programs, language immersion, etc.
Well, let's start with the no choice era first, since chronologically that came before the others. So you're talking about pre-1976. Describe for us the educational landscape of Milwaukee then, and the larger context of what was going on in Milwaukee.
Sure. Well, of course, back then, Milwaukee public schools used a neighborhood school system, as did most other cities in America. And because of the hypersegregation of the residence patterns in the city of Milwaukee, that resulted in a segregated school system. But it actually went beyond that, because Lloyd Barbie, who was the attorney in the lawsuit that tried to end segregated schooling in Milwaukee, had to go through a 13-year trial in which he proved that the school board actually deliberately segregated the schools beyond residence pattern by doing things like selectively denying transfers to certain students of certain races, by selectively denying teacher transfers from one school to another based on race, by engaging in the selective moving of boundaries to keep certain schools, school neighborhoods, white, while other neighborhoods were made to be African-American by these boundary adjustments. Also, of course, the use of intact busing, in which African Americans would board buses on the north side rather than attend overcrowded African American schools, and were then bused to the south side intact as a class and not allowed to interact with white students on the south side, then bused back at the end of the day. So that was a 13-year struggle to try to end that.
And so who were the proponents, whether out front or behind the scenes, of maintaining the system in that form?
Well, basically, you have a fractured school board at the time. It's a 15-member school board back in those days, not 19, or not rather 9 as it is now. They were elected on an at-large basis rather than a district basis, as the city currently uses. So with the at-large basis, It was very hard for African-American residents to muster enough votes to actually win any school board seats. And you have roughly about an 8-7 split on the board, those that were in favor of the status quo and those that were in favor of change. Certainly a majority of the residents in the city of Milwaukee at the time supported the neighborhood school system. It was what they grew up with. They believed it to be the best thing for their children, and they didn't want children, at least white children, taking long bus rides to the north side.
And so you say that most Milwaukee residents supported this. Was that support for that neighborhood school system fairly consistent in black and white neighborhoods?
That's a really interesting question. There was definitely more support in white neighborhoods for a neighborhood school system. But in the African-American neighborhoods, there was actually a surprising amount of support for keeping the neighborhood system intact. And what I have found through my research and what other scholars also show is that African-Americans fall into three distinct groups in Milwaukee. At that time, there's sort of an old guard middle class that would prefer to leave things as it was, not disturb the white community, that kind of thing. Then there was a more radical group that wanted rapid integration, two-way integration, where African Americans would be bused to the south side and then white students would be bused to the north side. And then there was also a more moderate group that was in between that wanted some reform and some change, but wasn't necessarily as radical as the other group.
You talk also about there being some different ideas of the best way to improve educational opportunities. One approach was recruiting and training black teachers. How big were the needs for more black teachers to be available at that period?
It was critical. There were hardly any African-American teachers in the district at the time, and there were almost none at the high school level or at the junior high school level. Most were confined to elementary schools. And what was particularly difficult was that Milwaukee Public Schools used a strict seniority system when assigning teachers back in those days. So African-American teachers, being more recent college graduates usually, did not have the seniority that the white teachers had, and so they got what were perceived as being the least desirable schools, the schools that none of the white teachers wanted to teach in. That ended up being where the vacancies were, and having low seniority, that's where they were assigned. So it's not just segregated students, it's also segregated faculty, with white teachers in white schools and African-American teachers in African-American schools, the few African-American teachers that there were.
Jim Nelson is the author of Educating Milwaukee, How One City's History of Segregation and Struggle Shaped Its Schools. We're talking about the different eras that he sees in the history of Milwaukee education. We've been talking about the no choice period. I just want to finish up on that with there was also an idea of increasing community controls within the schools. What did that look like for people who were advocating change?
Sure. The community control movement involved essentially taking back schools in the African American communities, bringing in an Afrocentric curriculum with lots of mentoring, a high level of parent involvement, and essentially a decentralization of the school system. And when the busing program did come through in the second period, the period of forced choice, there was a strong reaction among that group of African Americans in Milwaukee, because in order to make busing happen, some schools, Rufus King, for example, which was historically African American, had to be shut down. And that school was closed. And all but, I believe it was four students from the original population were removed from the school in order to make it an exam-based school. And then white students were brought in. So there were many people in the African-American community that really saw schools as a social community center, and that the busing program was going to cause them to lose that.
So you just kind of introduced the idea of forced choice as the next era that you address in your book. And it's when desegregation of Milwaukee schools was implemented. You say it's about 1976 to up to 1995. It defines the forced choice period. What exactly were the requirements that Milwaukee had to meet?
Well, Milwaukee had to have a certain percentage of its schools integrated, and there were different levels for different years. It was a three-year phase-in between 1976 and 1979. So in the beginning, for example, at the high school level, in 1976, only two schools were required to be integrated, and that was Washington High School, which was predominantly African-American, and Alexander Hamilton High School, which was primarily white. And then over time, the rest of the schools were required to have near equal black and white populations until all of the schools were integrated by 1979.
And so you talked about in the no choice era that the only busing that was really happening was taking students along with other students that looked like them from one area to another, but they were really being kept with people who were like themselves, not being integrated into other school communities. What changed with the busing of this era?
Well, with the busing then in the second era, what you end up having is you have magnet schools all throughout the city of Milwaukee. So magnet schools are specialty schools that have unique programs designed to attract students from all parts of the city, and in some cases also the suburbs. So, for example, Vincent High School had an agricultural studies program with a chapter of Future Farmers of America, kind of an interesting concept in an urban school. Rufus King, of course, got the big college-bound program. North Division was awarded a medical and dental specialty. At the elementary level, you found language immersion schools, such as the very popular Spanish immersion, the very popular German and French immersion schools that are still working very, very well today. You also had Montessori education and a variety of other specialties that were supposed to attract students. So this was supposed to be a form then of voluntary busing, but it didn't quite always work out that way. If, for example, there weren't enough students of a particular race who volunteered to ride a bus, various coercive methods could be used by the school district in order to induce change.
We're talking with Jim Nelson about his book, Educating Milwaukee, which looks at how racial issues and education have overlapped in Milwaukee.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you or your children a product of the Milwaukee school system? How do you see the city's racial challenges affecting educational policy and the quality of education in your city? If you live in another community, do these issues ring true for you too? Call 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with James Nelson. He's the author of the book, Educating Milwaukee, How One City's History of Segregation and Struggle Shaped Its Schools.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you see Milwaukee's racial issues affecting how successful its schools are? Have you been a longtime resident of the city? What changes have you noticed over the years regarding how well black and white students do? And what solutions do you think should be explored? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, Jim, we talked about the eras of no choice and forced choice. Let's move into the era of school choice. And when do you see that really starting in Milwaukee?
Well, I would say the era of school choice really begins around 1990 when you get a heavy push from a lot of different groups to introduce more options for students in the city. So you get a charter movement, and then, of course, you get the very controversial voucher movement, of which Howard Fuller and the Bradley Foundation were major proponents.
And for those who might not be quite clear on the difference, can you define what a voucher school is versus a charter school?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So a charter school is much closer to a traditional public school. Charter schools are required in most cases to accept all students, and they do receive public money. They may not be religiously based. A voucher school, on the other hand, which is what we typically think of when we think of the term school choice, is a fully private school. It may be religious or non-religious, and it accepts a voucher, a payment from the state to educate the student, which, as I said, may include a religious aspect. Voucher schools, because they are strictly private institutions, are much more free to do what they want in education and are exempt from certain state requirements.
So those voucher schools are private schools, and they are actually opponents of that program, say that they are siphoning money away from an already strapped public school program or public school system without the public school system having the same kind of regulation and control over them.
Correct.
And you describe this move towards the school choice program as being one where free market ideology and privatization are really high values. How are you seeing that playing out?
Well, you know, I'm afraid it's not playing out very well, because the idea is simple enough that if schools are forced to compete against each other, then they will have to provide the best education possible. But here's the thing, they're not competing on an equal playing field. When some schools get to select their own students and other schools have to take everybody, or in some cases the students that don't get into a voucher school, it's really not fair. The public school system, for example, has many more special education students with needs that private schools claim they're not equipped to meet. But the public schools have to meet those needs of those children every single day. So it's really comparing apples to oranges.
And, of course, your whole book is looking at differences, racial disparities and differences in how children from different communities and different economic levels are receiving their education and the quality of their schools. How do you see those overlays interacting with this school choice era?
Well, you know, what it is that in some cases, middle-class families just typically have more access. It's been documented in many cities across the United States that middle-class or upper-class families know the right people, they know the right procedures, they know how to get their children into selective public schools, selective charter schools, selective voucher schools. And unfortunately, lower-income families oftentimes don't have that knowledge. They don't have those connections. Those may be the families that are signing their children up for school at the last minute and just kind of get, unfortunately, whatever is left over. Those are the families that maybe the parents are working 2-3 jobs, that kind of thing, and don't have time to supervise homework, attend parent conferences, and that sort of thing. So there really ends up being a great deal of economic stratification in all of this, with not only racially segregated schools, but perhaps as disturbing, economically segregated schools.
So you teach in a magnet school, which is part of the public school system, but your school is drawing students from not a geographic area, but drawing them on different criteria. What are you seeing among the students that choose to come to a magnet school? Because that is one element of school choice, not in the way that people are often using it in shorthand, but being able to go to a magnet school is a choice as well.
I think that for the most part, there is a higher degree of parental involvement. These are the children of parents who take oftentimes extra steps to make sure that their children get a quality education. I can say that I definitely enjoy teaching in a magnet school. I like working with motivated young people who are eager to learn. And I'm excited to know that Milwaukee Public Schools is expanding the number of magnet offerings. They're taking successful programs and replicating them in other buildings so that way more students have access to those kinds of high in-demand programs.
In this era of school choice, who do you see are the students and the communities that are benefiting most and least from this particular structure?
Well, most and least, again, probably students who are a little bit more academically successful, whose parents know how to get them into these schools, they do probably benefit the most. The group that I'm really very concerned about are students with special needs, bilingual students, English language learners, and these other students who other schools would write off as difficult to educate. Do they really have the same choices as everyone else? I don't think so.
So we're 10, 15 years into the school choice era by your calculation. Overall, what kind of grades would you give it?
If I had to give it a letter grade, I would say I would give it a D. I do think it's done a good job for certain students. I wouldn't write it off as a failure by any means. But when, you know, we take a look at the various measures that we use in education for success, all schools, charter, choice, public, are just having difficulties educating low-income, special ed, English language learner students, these kind of marginalized groups that often fall through the cracks. And what I would really prefer is maybe instead of all of these different choices that we have, if we just had a couple really good choices and worked on making those the best choices possible to service students in the best ways possible.
James, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was James Nelson, the author of Educating Milwaukee, How One City's History of Segregation and Struggle Shaped Its Schools. He teaches high school social studies at the Golda Meier School in Milwaukee.